My name's Steven Sox. I was a stand-in on The Office, also played Justin Spitzer on The Office, and currently I'm the commissioner of The Office Fantasy Football League.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special Thursday edition of The Office Deep Dive. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. And yes, I'm here on a Thursday. Why? It's not Tuesday. Why a Thursday? Well, because I'm so excited. It's my favorite time of the year. It's the most wonderful time. Oh, we have to pay for that. Listen, those of you who follow me on social media know that I am a huge football fan. That's right. But did you know that a lot of the Office family actually love football too? In fact, we have our own fantasy football league that has been going on for 17 years, an official The Office Fantasy Football League. Now that 17 years, that's longer than some of you have been alive. Okay. Now, the competition started way back while we were filming the show, like season two-ish. And let me tell you, our directors hated it. Our assistant directors really hated it because nothing interrupted our ability to do our jobs like our obsession with beating each other. Yes, defeating, like pummeling one another. Seriously, we would spend as much time on fantasy football as we did on writing scripts or finding props or memorizing lines. And you know something? Those were some of my favorite times on set. So, in honor of our fantasy football crew, I'm going to be launching a special Thursday edition of the podcast called The Office Deep Dive Fantasy Edition, where I bring on special guests and members of our league to talk all things The Office and, well, maybe a little football too. You'll know some of the crew, like Rainn Wilson, John Krasinski. Others you're going to be meeting for the very first time, like my guest today. So, to kick things off, we're going to bring in a very special person. He is the glue that kept our league together, and a man I am so lucky to call my friend, our commissioner, Steven Sox. This is a man who's really an unsung hero of the show and a huge part of our Office family. Steven was a stand-in for 6 years. He appeared in several episodes as the character Justin Spitzer, and he was actually one of the last people to say goodbye to Steve on camera. He was on set with us day in and day out, in his words, biting his wallet during takes so he wouldn't ruin a shot laughing, and literally watching his own family grow up with The Office. But most importantly, he has kept our fantasy football league together all of these years. So please join me in giving a warm, deep dive welcome to the man who, well, has won the league, but also won all of our hearts, the amazing Steven Sox.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Brian.
There he is. What's up, Steven?
So good to see you.
I know, it's been so long.
It has. I mean, we've talked and texted, but to see you is really nice.
I know. What happened to your hair?
Well, it's I now want to even be more gone, like you.
It's, yeah, well, there you go.
You know, I was always bald. I just always wore a black cap backwards for lighting on the set just to make sure that I didn't, except for you, I'd take it off. And maybe Creed, because he had really light hair too. And so, you know, that was the way I kept my job, is to have a little dark on my top of my head.
No, I know. It just looks shinier. Let's just be, well, it just looks yes. Shine. Maybe you polished it this morning.
We're getting older, Brian.
Yeah, well, we sure are. Oh my gosh, it's so good to see you. What? So you're good? You survived?
Doing good.
Yes.
Yeah, we have survived. It was, It was, you know, I think for parents, it's the hardest part of the whole thing is you're trying to protect your kids in so many different ways, not only health-wise, but, you know, mental health-wise,
right,
with school. And we did distance learning for the last year and a half, and it's been good for them. That's not the case for a lot of kids, I'd say.
Oh, that's great. Well, and I feel like your family, I mean, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but your family was so much a part of the office experience as well. I just saw a video Rainn Wilson sent of his son, Walter, jamming with Creed. And I started thinking about your family as well. And Walter, I mean, Walter's like a grown-up now. And he was, the reason I know his age is because he was born when we were shooting the first four episodes of The Office. It's incredible.
We had that. We had that on the set. We had, you know, families being made. And I think probably the reason you're thinking that too is to have my wife and I on the set at the same time. I mean, that's a kind of a unique thing too.
Right. Okay. So now for those people who don't know, how would you describe the job of a stand-in? If you say standing in, then that, no. Okay, go ahead.
No, a stand-in is another Screen Actors Guild job on the set, is also known as second team, and we'll watch the rehearsals of a scene by the actors. The actors are also called first team. And usually during the last rehearsal, the camera department will throw down some marks on the, like tape marks on the ground, just spots that the actors will land on. That's called blocking. And then after rehearsal, the actors, you know, have some time because the camera and lighting are preparing for the shot and stuff. So the actors go off and, you know, finish up hair and makeup or go over your lines or whatever you guys do. And the stand-ins will stand in the places that are marked during that blocking and help the director of photography, the DP, light the scene and coordinate the movements of the camera and stuff. So the stand-in needs to just basically pay attention to what's going on in the scene and really get the movements down that the actor was doing. Sometimes, I mean, on The Office, it could be so easy. I mean, there's so many talking heads. You could sit there for 45 minutes. The lighting is pretty much preset, but it could be kind of complicated. I remember, like, Jim and Pam, The Proposal. The Proposal was, and you weren't there for that, but that's an entire production of the, with the rain and
right, at the gas station.
Next to the freeway, right. You know, and at the gas station, you would do like a run through without the actor just to make sure everything was done. So there were, one time I actually drove the car into the rain and the cars are going on the freeway and I got out and got to propose and knelt down in the rain and did it before John and Jenna. It was very exciting.
Right. Now, so you watch the rehearsal, you see where everybody's moving. And I know, for example, on The Office, sometimes adjustments would be made. Now then, would you communicate with the actors any sort of adjustments that happen?
That's a great question because you're supposed to give some adjustments, but there's a balance there. You have a balance of two things, what the actor wants to hear from a stand-in and also what the director wants to tell the actor himself. So you learn your relationship with the actor. Some actors don't really want any kind of instruction other than from a director. Others would love to sit down and get all the details and they just want to get it all together.
Right. Okay, so let's go back to circa 2007, 8-ish. What were you doing before The Office?
I was managing a gym
in
Santa Monica. And Lori was in between jobs, and she was doing some assistant work for people.
Lori, your wife?
Oh, yes, Lori, my wife. Yeah. And we're both actors, went through Second City here together, we're pursuing acting, looking for a job that was flexible. So she was kind of running errands for people. And one of the people she was running errands for, Kelly Cantley, an assistant director, and kind of ran out of work for Lori to do. And Kelly asked Lori if she'd like to do some background on a show she was working on, which happened to be season two of The Office. And so she knew we were Screen Actors Guild members and so offered that job. And Lori was like, in fact, I remember Lori calling me going, should I do background? I guess. I go, you're not doing anything. Let's do it. Let's work, right? So she did. And that booze cruise was her first episode.
Okay. Booze Crew.
So that's that season was... two. That's like mid-season two or something, I think.
Yeah, early mid-season two, but probably our most difficult episode to film was her first episode. That's
she
incredible.
She had problems just getting to set. I remember it was in Long Beach. This was kind of before... Well, I guess I had a cell phone, but I don't know if she had a cell phone. I don't really remember, but we didn't have like Waze or, you know, Google Maps and stuff. So her getting down to Long Beach, I remember she was calling me early, early in the morning. She's like, I'm lost. I don't, you know, and it was one of these things going, is this going to work out? Is this job going to work out? Are we, you know, is this the way we're going to start? And she had a blast. It was great.
Yeah. So she was there as the female stand-in for...
Yeah. Then, well, they only had... This is very weird, too, because Screen Actors Guild usually, because it's a union, designates that there'll be a stand-in for every actor on a set. And, I mean, we could have 15 actors on a scene at one time. And there was one stand-in at that time, a man.
Wow.
And they were like, oh, well, let's get a second stand-in. And so they need a female. And I don't know if it was because of the documentary style or however they got away with that through the union, but that's how it was. And... they asked Lori about that, and again, we were like, well, I mean, is it, you can have enough time, you know, to audition and stuff like that, you know, that kind of idea of the non-working actor going, I need to make time for my auditions and when all this stuff happens.
Right.
And and so she kind of reluctantly were like, okay, let's try this. And again, it was the best decision she made, you know. But that was start of season three, and they had two stand-ins at that time.
Okay. And then you eventually came on. What was the story there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I got to meet you guys.
Yes.
And so there was some rapport there, that her first season as a stand-in. And they lost the male stand-in. They were looking for someone to fill in. And we got a call from Kelly again saying, would you be interested? And I was so stressed at my job. I was managing this gym in Santa Monica. Like I said, I live in Studio City, like near Universal Studios, for people that might not know exactly. A long commute. It's like 20 miles. And the gym opens at 5 a.m. It closes at midnight. There wasn't a time I was away from the gym.
Right.
Really stressed out. And I knew Lori was having a great time. It was a time for us to be together. And that was really a no-brainer for me.
Right. So this was your first time standing in.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing. And but... I mean, not only did it, and as actors, that reluctancy that I talked about, you know, doing it, because there's this stigma that if you're standing in on a show, you're second team, you may want to be first team, but now everyone sees you as second team. And I haven't found that to be true. Not only do you have a chance to show professionalism and sometimes acting chops on a set in front of producers, but you meet a lot of great people. I would meet a new director every week. I mean, we had Ken Kwapis, Paul Feig, who is like the best dressed director in Hollywood. You know, Jeff Blitz, Harold Ramis directed the first time I ever acted on The Office. We had Jon Favreau. I mean, there was, and I didn't have, Lori had J.J. Abrams. You had J.J. Abrams and Josh Whedon. So it was a great experience to learn from those directors, but to see camera movement, lighting, set decoration. So when you go to make your own project, you kind of know what to do. But also when you're on the set as an actor, you know what's going on. I mean, especially after The Office, when there was a time where I was standing in on what's called a multicam show, which would be your typical comedy.
Right, with a laugh track and multiple cameras shooting at the same time, like Friends or Will and Grace.
Exactly. That isn't something that an actor learns. I mean, it is closer to, you know, I know you have a theater background like I do. It's closer to theater, but it still takes some, you know, you can go on it your first time as an actor and you can act confident in any job you do. You act confident, you can get away with a lot of stuff. But to really learn what multicam shooting is and have an idea and know what each camera is doing really helps when you're on the other side of the camera to know what they're asking of you and how to perform.
Right. Now, your main stand-in person, at least for the first 4 years you were there, was Steve Carell. This is Steve's birthday is this week.
That's right.
Happy birthday to Steve. How was it like working with him on the set? And how, you know, to give people an idea, actually, that I don't even know, how was he to talk and work with, you know, between the setups and then going back into the scenes? What did he want to hear?
Steve is very professional. He's a bit quiet on set for the most part. He wouldn't like a lot of adjustments. If there were major things, your mark has changed. Yes.
Right.
I'll tell you, your mark has changed. But he was very focused. But I have to say, he's the one that I and probably every actor on the show learned the most from. I mean, there was a lot of young actors on that set.
Right.
And not that Steve was old, but he was mature in his acting and his professionalism. I don't remember him instructing people how to do things, but as an example, he showed a lot of people the little things that you would just take for granted, actually, if you weren't in the industry. Being there on time, knowing your lines, having a rapport with the other actor, communicating with the other actor in a professional way, and especially when the camera's on that other actor, giving a full performance, even when it's not your coverage, right? And he was always doing that. And I've always said it, one of my top five favorite people in the world.
Right.
I mean, an amazing human being, just a giving man and just a straight up guy. Like you said, it's his birthday this week. I get a reminder it's his birthday. I give him a text every year. He never doesn't just text me back right away. I mean,
right.
When he left the show, he said, "You have my number." Well, we had played golf. You know, John, Chris Workman played with us,
yep.
Right? I remember that. And we had played golf. And so we had exchanged numbers and stuff. And I remember him saying, "You have my number. You have my email. You need anything, let me know." And, you know, at the time I was like, I don't know what I need. And I'm not going to blow it on, you know, what's on the, I've got this spread. What do you think? You know, but I actually, I've waited a couple of times to say, okay, this is the time to call or to text.
Right. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about him as an actor. And one of the things that was unique about him in a way, and I sort of have attributed it to his improv background, was, and I mean this with all love and respect, he didn't want to rehearse. And I always viewed it like he wanted to bring in the performance when it was live because he wanted everybody to be on their toes in a specific way. He did not deliver a ton of performance during the rehearsal versus James Spader, another amazing actor who wanted every gesture worked out in advance. So how was that different, transitioning from one to the other? How was that different for you?
James Spader wanted as much input as possible in every facet of the process. When he left to do hair and makeup and there was that 45 minutes of setup, I think in his mind, he was thinking, I might be missing something.
Right.
Let me get back and see, is there anything that you can give me, is basically what he would just sit and chat. And before he would get to a place where someone could pull him and say, we're ready, he would want to pull me to the side and just, let's talk. Also with James, the writers wrote a lot for Robert California. I mean, a lot of big dialogue pieces.
Speeches, that's right.
Oh, man, it was, and he was incredible at it. But he wanted someone on book at all times. So I had started doing that a couple of seasons in. I would be on book for anybody, but it was rarely needed, really. I just got time to sit next to the monitors and get close to the director and follow the script. It was fascinating for me. But with James Spader, every word needed to be exactly right. So if he didn't get the line right, he wanted to know what it was and reinforce that. And so that was different. Now, Steve, you know, got all his lines and would sometimes call for a line. But Steve during rehearsals, he giggled a little. I remember him giggling right. A lot, like, because it was funny. And he'd take that time to laugh and get it out. I mean, although you see a bunch of outtakes where Steve will laugh, you know,
right.
Which are hilarious, but he would laugh a lot during scenes because we all enjoyed it and laughed and had fun. You have to remember when we're recording, we're right there, and no matter how funny it is, you can't laugh. It's not like these multicam shows where you're laughing, the audience is laughing. We're just biting our wallets and
of you watching the monitor, that's right.
They usually put the monitor pretty close to the scene because the director could run out real quick and say, hey, I want to do this. And so you're just like, you know, biting your knuckle, just try not to laugh sometimes.
Right. I remember at times people would be kicked out of the room. Jen Salata specifically comes to mind. Like she would just be like, Jen would be like, I'm doing a talking head, and she just couldn't, and was like, Jen, leave. Go find a monitor somewhere in another room. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So James really worked with you before,
during, and
after. Yeah.
There were times where I would go into his trailer and we'd just run lines.
Right.
You know, because I would have some time off, or we'd do it during lunch or whatever. And it was great. There were times where you would hand me the script and say, hey, run this with me, or Rain would do that. But, you know, these were big, meaty dialogues. These were like little mini, like audition pieces, you know? Like,
right.
They were long. It was a lot of words. And he did so well with them. You know, he really did.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite episode of the show that you worked on?
Well, I mean, Benihana Christmas, it, for multiple reasons. It's even as just a fan of the show, I believe it's the best Christmas episode. It's during a peak time of the show, and I did get a line on the show, so that made it closer to my heart. But it's a really great episode.
Now, did you know that you were going to speak? I don't remember. Were you cast in advance of that?
No. So Kelly Cantley called me to say there was, quote unquote, a featured background extra that was going to be at the Benihana table. And it was not scripted to have any lines, this character, but she didn't see a reason. I guess she had prepped with Harold Ramis the week before and said, this person's going to have to talk. And so she said, it's a good chance. So would you want to do it? I go, yes. So, I mean, duh. I mean, it's so funny, right? People go, would you do this for me? Like, what? Like you, would you do this podcast for me? Yeah, Brian, I'm there. And so when I got on the set, it was just doing background. We walked through it, and the very first rehearsal, Harold Ramis came to me and said, wouldn't you want to say something? And I said, yeah, I think so. And so
I'll deliver a four-page monologue for you, Harold.
Oh, I would. But it didn't matter. I was like, oh, if I just say one word, this is so great.
And your character's name was?
Justin Spitzer.
Justin Spitzer.
Isn't that funny?
So Justin Spitzer was a writer on the show, mm-hmm. and they named the character Justin Spitzer. Now, does this get confusing for you with your IMDb page, that you're Justin Spitzer on The Office, but not the writer, Justin Spitzer? I don't know. Right. I think it's so funny.
It is funny. In fact, I remember as I worked on the show more, and there were a couple other times where I could be in front of the camera, I just legitimately, and this is probably not the thing to do as an actor who's basically given some roles, I went to Greg Daniels, creator of the show, and I said, how is this Justin Spitzer character now part of he was at the Benihana Christmas table and nobody knew him, but now he's in the warehouse during was it Crime Aid?
Right.
Was it Crime Aid? Yeah. And in an elevator, and Greg always had a complete backstory contrived of, yeah, there's no reason why this guy couldn't have, he's in Scranton.
Right.
You know, he could
right.
So a question that should never be asked by an actor. Are you sure I'm needed here?
How many times did Justin Spitzer appear in The Office?
Actually being seen, I think, as it was all said and done, only three or four times. I think four times you can actually see me with dialogue.
Okay.
But then for me as an actor, there were a lot of voiceovers too that were available, because there was no loop group for The Office. A loop group is a group of five or six people who go into a sound booth and do all the sounds of a crowd, a little individual, hey, over there, and grab one of those. Hey, Patty, good to see you. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So when the editors would be going through and doing rough cuts of the episodes, I'd get a text saying, hey, at lunch, could you come over and throw down a line and we'll just see if it works. So it could be something on a car radio. It could be, something that was actually usually scripted, but he was like, just throw it down because I need a voice to show it to Greg, but they haven't cast it yet. So it always gave me a chance to do it. And if Greg liked it, he could stay. And if it stayed, it was mine, which is great.
Right.
or Lori's, you know, so.
Right.
So I think we did end up doing, I just go by like the little residuals now, but I think it's like 8 or 9 episodes.
Yeah. You were
Whenever I get a big residual check, I always think of you. I always go, if I'm getting a big residual check for that day, you know, big for me, I'm going, oh, this is how fun to have done 188 episodes.
What was the most challenging episode for you to work on?
Wow, that's a great question. I can't think of any episodes that were mentally or emotionally challenging. I'd have to say Steve's last episode.
Right.
You know, I was going to say something like it was hot, like when we went out into the woods or something. But, you know, to be honest, saying goodbye to Steve, it was set up so well for us as a crew. On Thursday, you know, Monday, we shot Monday through Friday. On Thursday of that week, we went to Ontario Airport and shot all the airport stuff. And we said goodbye to Michael Scott. He got on a plane and left. And that Friday, the next day was the last day for Steve. And we were back at the stages. I feel like that's when we said goodbye to Steve.
Right.
I was lucky in the fact that in that moment, it was one of these things going, hey, put a suit on and show up on the last day. Because Greg said, I want to throw you in the background somewhere. And so for those that remember, Steve's final time in the office bullpen, he says something to Creed and has a great moment with John and walks to the elevator and goes down the elevator and out to a car and goes to the airport. Well, his last scene is walking into that elevator, which is not a real elevator. Actually, we're on the first floor of everything, but the doors just close and then the doors open up on the other stage and we're, it's the movie magic. But, so they had like a FedEx guy type of background character that was going to be in the elevator and walk out of the elevator as Steve was walking in the elevator. And they just put me in with that FedEx guy. And so I would walk out of the elevator, Steve would walk in, and then I just waited in the lobby. And the doors closed, and we waited and held, and they'd say cut, and the doors would open. And that last time, I remember the doors opened, and we knew it was it. And I was the first one, right? I was literally 6 feet away, and I just hugged him. You know, it's Steve. He didn't even hesitate. He just hugged me, and it was very emotional. It was very emotional.
Yeah.
But that was probably the toughest. The Thursday was really emotional too. I mean, it's a great ending for that character. I mean, it ended up not being the ending, but exactly. But you know, he came back. But when he takes the microphone, when he takes the lavalier mic off and that's what she said and you can't hear him, it's brilliant. It's really brilliant. And but watching him walk away after Pam says goodbye to him was there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, but on camera it's interesting, you were the second to the other than Pam, you were the last one to pass him by in the elevator.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a special moment. Because we had gotten close. We had all gotten close, and we didn't want to see this family broken up. Not only do you want to keep working, you know, we knew Steve leaving was a big part of our show, but he was just a wonderful person. He is a wonderful person to just have in your life.
Yeah. The greater loss for the show, Steve Carell or Michael Scott?
For me, it's Steve. I can always go back and watch Michael Scott. I can always appreciate that character over and over. I mean, I have a 13-year-old daughter now that started binging the Office like during pandemic time, and it was like awesome. And we get to the end. Honestly, those last episodes were very painful and emotional, and I was like, oh, and we just start back at the pilot.
Yeah.
And I can go back and see that and watch that. But I had limited time with Steve.
Yeah. So you were on the show 5 to 6 years, mm-hmm. Which is a long time to work with the same group of people. How do you feel that The Office, the experience, the people were different than other things that you've worked on?
You know, Greg Daniels said, and I think he said this in front of everybody, he said that this show was really special and that people work their entire career and don't get a show like this. Not only 9 years on a show, but the group of people. And I didn't appreciate it as much as I do now. It is by far the best show I ever worked on because of the people. I got close a couple times. There were a couple of shows I worked on. I go, this is what a great group, but they didn't last. And when we didn't have the growth together.
Right.
I mean, you talk about family. When you see people having children, getting married, getting divorced, having deaths in their family, and you're there for that. That's what made The Office so special and made us all so close and why we probably communicate and stay together so much. In fact, I just went down to San Juan Capistrano this weekend, went to a restaurant, and Tad Schultz, who was one of the producers, assistant producer, assistant to the producer.
Right.
I ran into him. He's not even in that part of the business anymore, and he lives down in San Juan at Capistrano, and I was like, oh, and you're just bonded.
Right.
And I didn't even spend that much time with Tad. You know, Tad didn't really know a lot of you guys. He's in a trailer and doing all the post stuff. And,
right.
And all that kind of stuff, not the actual shooting. And but anytime I see somebody that is from the show, all we can talk about is the show.
Right. You know?
I mean, and I did the finale of Be Positive as an actor, and I was walking back to my trailer and ran into Andy Buckley, who was doing another show at Warner Brothers. And I knew he had to be someplace because there were a lot of PAs around him going, Andy, but we talked for like 45 minutes.
Right.
And there's right. no way you can. I mean, we talked about golf and football, but we talked about just old times.
Right. And you had a family, basically, that was born during
both
the show.
Both our kids. I know. I mean, Lori and I were both working on the show full time until we had our first child. And at that point, we knew someone was going to stay at home. And so she did. And there were times, though, once I had gotten through, because we had long seasons.
Right.
Long hours, 23 episodes and long hours. So there were times where, I wanted some baby time and my wife wanted some adult time. The producers were amazing at letting us swap off for weeks at a time where Lori could get a break into civilization,
right.
from babies.
I mean, I would say at this point, you are the person most responsible for at least a specific subgroup of people on the show. Steven is the commissioner of the Office Fantasy Football League. Steven, this is a lot of work. You're talking about wrangling cats, those of us, especially the actors on the show. Now, we're in year, what year is this now? 17?
This is season 17.
17. Yeah. We are about to embark on season 17 of the Office Fantasy Football League. I can't even believe it. When we started this, there was no online draft that happened. We started doing the draft on a yellow legal pad. And the draft would take us weeks. There were no time limits. No. For those of you who do fantasy football, when it was your turn to draft, you got past the yellow legal pad. This is 100% true. And then you would have to make your pick. But you might be in the middle of a scene, or you might be in the middle of standing in and then have to go be on book. And it could take hours, or it could be passed to me and I could have gone home for the day. So it's not until the next day that we pick back up.
The day could have ended. That's right.
Yes. 17 years. You are the commissioner. Are you excited that we're back?
Oh, of course. And last year we did have some of the guys Zoom the draft, which was great.
Yes,
so we got to all see each
fun.
Other.
Yes.
Yeah, that was fun. And we'll do that again. So I am looking forward to that. I do not look forward to the wrangling of the cats, as you say. I mean, we have a very modest ante-in, you know. So getting the money from everyone isn't a difficult pay for everyone, but it can be really hard to get the money. And to be honest, I've paid out without getting everything in.
Oh,
but,
God.
But you want to have, like, you want to make sure everyone is awake here, you know. Like, I want to make sure I know everyone's coming back, right? But to actually get in touch with 12 other people that are doing all different things, and almost half our group are actors that could be anywhere in the world. I mean, maybe not now with the pandemic as much, but I remember trying to get John, and John can be one of the hardest ones to get.
Krasinski? No. I'm kidding.
and I'm emailing and texting, and you know, I'm thinking these things are going to go through. And there was one time where he didn't get back to me for a few days, and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of the Amazon shooting something." I'm like,
"Jack Ryan."
I had no Wi-Fi.
On a plane. Right. Yeah. Okay. So 17 years. Now, mm-hmm. there has really, in the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, we haven't really had any turnover, but who are the guys who are in now? Myself, Rainn Wilson,
mm-hmm.
John Krasinski, previously mentioned, you.
Andy Buckley,
that's right. David Wallace.
Owen Ellickson. The writer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Warren Lieberstein, the writer.
Yes.
Mike Bertolina, who was props at the time. He's
yes.
a producer now.
Yes.
Chris Workman, who I mentioned earlier, but he is he's a camera operator now, but he was camera assistant at the time of the show. Lee Kirk. Jenna's husband, right?
Jenna's husband. He qualified because he directed an episode of
He
the
directed
Office.
An episode. That's correct.
Yes, you
it
had to
just
have worked
of Jenna.
On the show. Yes.
Nick Carbone, sound department.
Yes.
And Greg Ubaraga, who was one of our favorite PAs
yes,
on the show.
That's right.
And Greg is now a marshal at Griffith Park Golf Course.
Yes.
As one of his jobs.
Yes.
And I know he's loving it. He's an incredible golfer.
He's an incredible golfer. Yes. Mm-hmm. He's way better than me. Okay. Who has won the Office League the most times?
There's no doubt that our most celebrated player or manager is Warren Lieberstein.
Okay.
He did not start until 2012.
He didn't.
When I look back, I forgot he won his first year.
Oh, he must be cheating.
And then he just had a 3-year streak a couple years ago. So he's won 4 times. And then he got a second place. So he's placed 5 times out of 9 seasons.
Right. How many times have I won?
You have not won, Brian. But you have.
It feels like
you
I've
actually
won.
Have the. You have the distinction of placing in the top 3 the most.
The most. I've placed the most. I'm in the money.
Twice you have gotten second place, and twice you've gotten third place.
So 4. Well, then that must mean I'm at least tied with Warren. He's won 4 times.
Oh, I meant
placed, but not won.
I've given Warren the award. You're not Warren.
Right. Okay, placed. Okay, aside from Warren, I've placed in the top. I've placed second and third the most.
Yeah, second, third the most. But good news is, Krasinski's never won.
That's not surprising.
I remember that was something that Rain always would dig him about.
Yes,
Rain won twice.
Rain's
and got
won
a third place one time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. What about you? Have you won? You've won.
I won in 2013, and then I've taken second place twice and third place once.
Okay. I mean, this is what do the Cubs say? This is my year.
You're always there, Brian. You're always right there. I mean, to
I
think
know.
That the 2 times that you were in second place. You went to the championship game twice.
Right. I just
or
needed...
one game away from the championship game two other times.
It feels like you're just being nice to me. I know. I haven't done
that. I have to tell you, it is heartbreaking. When I've come in second place twice as well. And when I've lost that game, it's usually around Christmas time, it ruins my Christmas.
Yeah. No, I know. There is no
It probably
Christmas.
Ruins the Christmas for my family as well.
How did you get to be commissioner?
It was because nobody else wanted it.
That's probably right.
To be honest. And I did want it. I mean, I love fantasy football. It's really, besides the corralling of everybody and dispensing of the little bit of money, but I'm able to be a facilitator of us staying together. It really is fantastic because there's a lot of ribbing that goes on between us. We're close like family, so there's no holds bar, actually.
Right.
But that's been a great way for us to stay together. I mean, we run into Andy Buckley. We talked about old times, but we talked about football.
Right.
And I had to be the biggest part of that as I could.
Yeah. Well, I will say that last year, I mean, who knew what Zoom was? I didn't know what Zoom was before, you know, this nonsense that happened. But that was really fun that we kind of finally did the draft. I know that one year we drafted from the computers.
Yeah,
fun. On the bullpen set of The Office, when we were shooting The Office, we drafted from the computers once or twice.
Yeah, I remember one time, and I think we brought like a six-pack of beer, maybe.
There was some beer. Yeah, there was some
maybe
beer.
Two beers, maybe?
Maybe, just a couple.
It was fun.
But other than that us getting together last year, that was really fun. So the reigning champion, who won last year?
Andy Buckley. He beat Warren in the finals.
Andy Buckley took it down. Now he's definitely cheating, right? Because it doesn't seem like, you know. Oh, and his son helps him.
His son. I think the actual, the name that you've registered as, I believe is his son's name. So he's using his son's account, I think. But
it's a burn.
I think he's getting some help. But
yeah. What are some of our best team names? I know that Chris Workman was a big 49ers fan.
Oh, he had so many different...
About Gore.
Yeah. Gore no more when Gore left.
Yes.
And then mine's always been, you know, Steven Sox. I've always been Sox it to him.
Yes.
And...
Original. Cute. Clever. Now, I guess this makes me like a fuddy-duddy. I can't believe I just used the term fuddy-duddy. I have been Bombers. I've just bombed. Yeah. I don't know. I never do. Rain, he gets really into the names. Usually it's something slightly perverted.
Yes. He's had, I don't know what your rating is on your podcast. I
mean, it doesn't matter.
He's had Cut My Balls for, but Cooper Cup, you know, like
yes,
K-U-P-P, yes. My Balls, for a couple years. But he just changed it to Cut My Footballs. So I don't know if he's maybe I don't know why he's cleaning it up. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've always been BB Bombers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Always.
And
I'd say Rain is the biggest trash talker.
Rain is. And Rain loves to send you the crappiest trade offers.
Oh my God.
Ever. Like yes. You're gonna bite on that. Like, or he's getting a trade offer from someone else, and he'll come to me and say, "What do you think about this?" And I'm going, why am I helping you? First of all, I'm the commissioner. Second of all, I'm playing against you in the standings.
Yes.
So I've learned actually to help him.
To hurt him.
You know, in my own way.
Yes. Right. I think that we're unique in a way, and this is because I am in other leagues, and I think that the biggest benefit of us and it being 17 years is there's no controversy, right? Like it feels like in other leagues, it's like, well, how many days do you get to accept a draft, or how many players, or this or that? Like, there's just kind of no nonsense, and that all of that stuff has kind of gone away. There's really no controversy. And the draft order is uniquely determined by?
Always my kids. We always grab a hat, a Dunder Mifflin hat. We've gotten so many over the years, right? And I put everybody's name in a hat, and my kids take turns pulling the names out of the hat. We always, the first pull will be position 12, and we'll go all down to the first pick. Which is funny, because I have one other league where he'll do a very similar thing, and the first out of the hat is number one. And I've always had this like problem with that. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You never say who won first, and then let's talk about 2, 3 to 12. I mean, that's not how you do anything. You would never, they don't give the award first place first, and then everybody, you know, oh, let's wait around for second place.
The Emmy goes to, now, let me give you the nominees.
No, it makes no sense. So I've been picked, last to be 12th in that league, and I've been, well, I should have been the first pick, but anyway.
Right.
It is a pretty unique way, and it's a really great way to get my kids involved in enjoying that, and just seeing the age of the kids as it progresses. Because I'll videotape it and send it out to everybody, and at least gives a chance for everyone to say, yeah, we are getting older.
Yes. What I know the answer to this question, but who's your football team?
The New Orleans Saints. I'm from New Orleans, originally from New Orleans.
Yes, New Orleans. You've got Rain. Big Seahawks, right. John, big Patriots. I might have the Green Bay Packers represented. And I would say we are kind of homers in that way. Now, not 100%, because we do take it seriously, but I would say that we all try to get at least somebody.
I definitely try to get somebody from the Saints, which has been easy the last, you know, few years with their offense. You know, if it's not Drew Brees, I want to get Kamara, or I want to get Michael Thomas, and that kind of hurt me last year. But, but you know, I want to be in this group. I want to win, but I also, we have such a great time. Like when you talk about how there's no controversy, I think of like you're just kids on the playground, right? You show up, you got a basketball, and there's a hoop, and we're just playing. That's what we want. We want to have fun. So grabbing one of our players, yeah, is definitely a thing we want to do, even if it's not maybe the smartest draft choice. You know, we'll move up the draft for a hometown player, most definitely.
Right. Okay. My producer came up with this idea. Let's see how well you or I do. All right. If you were to hold a draft with just office characters, who would you draft first, and what position would they play?
Craig Robinson, fullback. Because no one's stopping him at the goal line.
Okay, that's fair. That's all right. That's fair. What do you think Kevin's position would be? Although, see, you said Craig Robinson, but you mean Daryl Philbin.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Yes,
you're right.
Daryl Philbin. What do you think Kevin would play?
I think Kevin Malone would have to be...
deceptively athletic, remember, basketball.
Yes, and offensive linemen are, and that's where I would put him, because you need someone that's going to have legs like tree trunks that are set in the ground and stable. And that was your persona on the show, a stable,
yes,
physical person, almost an immovable object at times. So I could see the focus of Kevin just being, I'm going to block. And I could see that. Nothing too complicated.
No, I think that would be a standard response. I think,
what do you
though,
think?
I think if you were a writer on The Office, there would probably be a final play in the game, and somehow Kevin would run by everyone and catch a long touchdown. That would be where their minds would go.
I could see that.
who would get kicked out of the game first?
Oh boy. BJ, probably. I mean, Ryan Howard.
Ryan. Ryan. Okay, fair enough.
He'd piss off somebody.
Yeah.
I could see Meredith Palmer doing something where she just would have to be removed from the game.
Yeah. Well, there are substance abuse There might be testing. He might fail some sort of test.
Right.
Who would be the MVP?
Michael Scott. He'd be the quarterback, the fearless leader. For as ridiculous as some of the plays would turn out to be, and as nonsensical as they would turn out to be, at the end of the day, you knew it was an honest choice, and it probably fooled the hell out of the other team.
Well, that's true.
Because it would make very little sense sometimes.
Again, I think it would be Jim. I don't know how, but it would be Jim.
Well, that's, you've been seeing those pictures of his abs.
Exactly. Kidding me? All right. So we may come back and we may talk about this. Now, our draft is coming up very soon. We get a lot of questions. I get a lot of questions directly, like I'm an expert. I've been doing it 17 years. You just heard I've never won. But we'll talk about the league once we have the player set. What do you think about that?
That sounds great. I always love talking fantasy with you.
Love it. Now, Stephen, sorry, before I let you go, I know you have a podcast of your own called If We Knew Then. Tell us a little bit about that.
If We Knew Then, yes. Liam was born in 2010 with Down syndrome. And it was an incredibly frightening time for us. When Liam was born, we didn't know very much about Down syndrome or diversity, inclusion, all these words that we hear today. But most of the information we had about Down syndrome was not very positive. It was certainly not hopeful. And so we were really looking for a place where parents could hear those stories of accomplishments and also get useful information, you know, about therapies or educational supports, but just to hear positive messages. And we initially thought that these things were going to be totally geared to the Down syndrome community, but I guess through constantly learning and evolving, we've realized that so many of our guests have given information that's needed by all parents, and it's helped us with both our kids. We just recently talked to an attorney about family trusts. We talk about the importance of self-care for parents through guided meditation was one way. We had a pediatric dentist on just about introducing your child to healthy dental routine, you know, and we had a Zen Buddhist priest on the show talk about fear. I mean, that's a main thing. We're only scared of the unknown and fearful of that because we don't know it, right? So the more information we can gather, the less fear we have. And these things benefit all parents. And really, to get down to it, though, even the stories that are more specific to Down syndrome, we all learn from.
Right.
We interviewed a couple times Chris Nikic. He is the first person with Down syndrome to finish an Ironman. He won the Jimmy V Award on the ESPYs recently. And how he broke through stereotypes. And we had a young dentistry student from Syria, Sadr Issa, who was raised by a father who has Down syndrome. I mean, his father has been married for 30 years, goes to work every day to support his family. Or siblings, like we've had our daughter on. One of the things that we see the most is that parent is so worried for the other kids or the other family members. Like, what's the repercussions is the thought process. What's going to happen to these, to the kids we have? And overwhelmingly, we found that it's a wonderful experience.
Right.
We got a chance to talk to Steve Guffison from 10,000 Maniacs, and he had his sister, Kathy, had Down syndrome. And we talked to him about what he learned about her. And many people from the entertainment industry, too, to talk about the importance of inclusion in media. And that is a big hashtag right now, inclusion. And it is very important for the disability community as well.
Right.
But we talked to Julianne Robinson. She's the EP of Bridgerton. And that show has broken a lot of barriers. But she also did a movie about an adult with Down syndrome. So yes, the podcast focuses on Down syndrome, and I highly recommend sharing it with anyone you know who has someone with Down syndrome in their life. But I think in doing it, I've realized how much we can learn from each other, especially, you know, from people we assumed were very, very different from ourselves, you know, and we really aren't all that different.
Right.
When it gets down to it. I mean, that's inclusion. And the more we include those stories, tell those stories, the more we include all the people in our society to join the table, to join the discussion, to truly be a voice in our society, the better we all are.
Right. If we knew then, a podcast from Stephen and his wife, Lori, for what it's worth, some of my favorite days on set were when people's kids who were either born during the show or not came in. Sophia, Liam, Walter, we talked about before, Rain's kid. Just
Angela's daughter.
Angela's daughter. Well, she basically lived there, right?
Totally. I think she did live in the trailer.
She lived in the trailer. She never went home. No, Isabel, that, of course, is not true. Stephen, thank you so much for coming and talking to me. You had a very significant and important role on the show, but also you were an important part of our Dunder Mifflin family. And I want you to know you, Lori, your kids, all of you are very special to me. And I appreciate you coming in. I appreciate all of the work that you do keeping the fantasy football league going. And I love you and appreciate you. And let's talk some more throughout the season.
Love you, Brian.
All right.
Definitely. Thanks for just bringing back some amazing memories. I mean, there's not often that we get to like sit down and really like talk about, you know, I don't know if you ever knew any of that way I got on the show or anything, and it's just neat to hear that stuff and to say that stuff. Really, it's really fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, Stephen, aka Socks It To Me. Stephen, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today. We're going to have you back throughout the season to keep us posted on how the competitors are faring, how our teams are doing this year. Also, catch Stephen and his wife, Lori, on their podcast, If We Knew Then, where they talk about their family, parenting, and they do incredible work raising Down syndrome awareness. Also, keep listening to this podcast, The Office Deep Dive, for future updates about The Office Fantasy Football League. Until next time, we will see you. Well, we'll see you on Tuesday. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our producers for this episode are Liz Hayes, Emily Carr, and Diego Tapia. And our intern is Hannah Harris. My main man in the booth is Colin Tedeschi. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.